Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our host today is Tracy Dietz, CEO of Donor Bureau, known for her innovative approach to data-driven decision-making, helping organizations maximize their impact. Tracy will be leading the discussion with Sasha Eisenberg, a journalist and author specializing in the intersection of politics, data, and technology. Sasha's work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and other major outlets, making him a respected voice on the evolution of campaign tactics and voter behavior. Tracy and Sasha will discuss Sasha's latest book, The Lie Detectives, in search of a playbook for winning elections in the disinformation age. Together, they will arm you with the tools to navigate the challenges of disinformation while also preparing for the ethical, technological, and strategic dilemmas that lie ahead in political consulting. Tracy, take it away.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. Sasha, thank you again for joining us this evening. Very excited to talk to you. It's been a pretty crazy cycle, as I think we probably can all agree on. In The Lie Detectives, you dive deep into how disinformation is influencing campaigns. How has disinformation altered the playing field for political consultants and strategists?
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. And, you know, I think here disinformation is sort of a catch-all for the sort of viral internet. I think together that the big challenge here isn't really at its core about truth versus falsity or how accurate a given claim is. The challenge really for political consultants, for operatives, many of whom were trained on kind of the era of mass media, is adjusting to an era of sort of decentralized media. And so the task, it was pretty easy if you go back 30 years, 20 years to get a sense of what people were hearing. You know, if you wanted to know what voters in a given district or state were the information flows that they were being exposed to, you could look at the front page of the local newspaper. You could see how many points of TV a given message was putting in front of them. It was a little harder to get a sense of what they were seeing via direct mail, but the bulk of the information they were getting, you knew it. Now, with people getting so much of their information online, and especially from social media, people inside campaigns at any level don't have that same sense of confidence. And so a whole series of communications decisions that were pretty straightforward for consultants in the kind of mass media era. When do you respond to an attack, for example? When do you try to correct a lie? Getting the sort of the knowledge base to confidently draw those conclusions in this media environment is much tougher.
And when you say decentralized media, are you talking about TikTok, Facebook, anything that's not your normal broadcast newspaper?
Yeah, you know, anything, you know, and I think there's always been word of mouth in politics. And I think that political consultants have always been alert to this going back, you know, 250 years in the United States. People hear things about politics from their friends or at the VFW or, you know, in their workplace. But those things couldn't reach scale, right? So, yes, you wanted to get the prominent local neighborhood figures to like your candidate in part because you knew that there were people around them who listened to them. But we're talking about maybe they had a dozen or a few dozen people who were in their orbit. And it was very hard for that individual to spread by word of mouth a message or an idea or an argument or a lie or a claim or a conspiracy theory. And so, but now we see that it's very easy for any individual, including people who are outside of the normal political process, right? And so what's, and this could be, you know, obviously we talk a lot about foreign governments, but this could just be people who are individuals who are, you know, playing on the internet, who all of a sudden are in a position to change minds about an issue, about a candidate or a party. And so I think the important thing here is the asymmetry. If you are a political consultant, you probably until very recently were in an environment where you spent all day thinking about what your opponent is going to do, right? You know, if I say X, how will they respond to it? You know, if I decide that this issue contrast works for me, how are they going to integrate that into their response? How much money do they have? Where are they going to put it? All of these things. Now you're in an environment where often the opposition is not your opponent. It's not another candidate. It's not another party. It's not another super PAC or or labor union or some entity that's operating under the same constraints you are, right? They're not operating under FEC or state campaign finance limits. They're not having to disclose their fundraising and spending. They don't have, you know, you can't go and look at FCC records to understand how and where they've placed their media. They are fundamentally unaccountable. And that is a real challenge. And so I think that that's the core of it. What the core of it is this asymmetry. You're now having to defend against people who are not under the same rules you are, and they're not held accountable in the same way you are. And frankly, whose motives you don't understand. Like if you're a political consultant thinking about your opponent and you're thinking about another person who's a lot like you, just on the other side of a contest, but you understand how their mind works and the tools they have at their disposal. If you're trying to think about if your opposition is, you know, a kid in their basement who's just doing it for laughs or trying to game online advertising clicks for money or isn't from a foreign country doing it for some other motive, it's probably very difficult for you to put yourself in their shoes and anticipate what they're saying and why.
So what do you do in situations like that where your average person on social media or whatever medium it is that they are on has, you know, produced videos or content that is factually inaccurate, but it's getting millions and millions of views and spreading everywhere? What do we do to counteract that for our own campaigns or for our side?
So the first question is getting to that conclusion of, is it getting millions of views, which is often not straightforward. You know, all the different platforms have different levels of sort of transparency in terms of how much something is spreading. And millions of views sounds like a lot. Are they millions of views in the United States? Are they millions of views among people who are over the age of 18? Are they in the state or district that you care about as part of your strategy? Are they? And so one thing is getting the data to tell you a useful story about, is this actually getting in front of the voters I care about, right? And at the core for a campaign, you have, you know, basically three main audiences that you care about, maybe two. You know, one is persuadable voters, and the other is, you know, your supporters or prospective supporters probably getting demotivated and less likely to want to volunteer or donate or get involved. Or maybe elites who would be ambivalent about endorsing you or something. But those are really what you care about. And if it's getting in front of millions of people who aren't in one of those categories, probably what you want to be doing is ignoring it altogether. And I think that's the first tough decision you have to make is figuring out, do I engage with this at all?
So what are some of the tools and technologies that are out there so you are able to understand and track sort of what you just said?
Yeah, so there are a lot of sort of social listening tools that will tell you some version of here's what people are talking about online. And I think the important thing before you use any of them, and a lot of them are similar enough that I don't think I could give like a useful buying recommendation on them. The useful thing is to have a baseline going in, because otherwise you will see large numbers. This, you know, so this is trending today, or millions of people are spreading this. Well, compared to what? Are people always talking about this? Are millions of people always millions of people are talking about Taylor Swift online every day? So like a video about Taylor Swift, let's just say, getting millions of views might not be novel. Millions of people are talking about vaccines every day. You have that, and if you just tune in on one random day, you might say, wow, millions of people are sharing a video about vaccine safety. Should I be worried about that for my campaign? The only way you can make that determination is if you have some sense of what is the normal level of conversation about this. And so, you know, the main character of my book is this woman, Jori Kred, who's this basically became like the first counter disinformation operative in American politics. And the first project she does she works for Democratic and progressive campaigns and groups. But the first thing she does is she creates what she calls a landscape analysis. And this is basically, let's map in a given geographic area or in a given subject area, what are the accounts that are connected that move traffic? And what is a sort of regular level of discussion on their topics on a given day? So we can at least have some context if we dip in to see, is this a spike? Is this going just through the normal people who are always talking about vaccines or Taylor Swift? Or Are we seeing the possibility that this is, because so many of these, Celine could get millions of views on the internet just by being in some little corner of an online community. Often for a campaign, the worry is this breaking out of that self-contained online community to get in front of a larger slice of the electorate, wherever it is? Is this possibly going to get media attention from regular media organizations? So part of the idea of that landscape analysis is this just the same people who are always talking about this topic, talking about it today? Or is this an abnormal thing where it might make the jump to start reaching people outside of their world?
You think that fact-checking is going to be important, or do you think that fact-checking has become almost irrelevant? And I say that because there was an article, I think maybe 8 years ago, I don't even remember, it was in The Atlantic, about how they did this study, and they told a set number of people something that wasn't true. And then 4 hours later, they told those people that was in fact not true and gave them information that proved that it wasn't true. And I feel like 90% of them still believed what they were first told. They didn't change, even though they were told and shown proof that it wasn't true.
So there are a lot of ways to do fact checking wrong, which is, you know, we have a lot of cognitive science research that suggests that correcting a misimpression can often end up reinforcing it in the minds of the people who suspect it. But they hear, I say, no, I didn't just murder that guy last night. If that's what you hear from me first, you probably start wondering, maybe he murdered that guy last night. And so there are sort of some best practices that cognitive psychologists have come up with that help avoid the problem of kind of reinforcing the lie. The other problem is that the way the internet is built, especially sort of algorithmic social media, is that you can end up by trying to fact check, engaging with a post with the goal of fact checking it. You can end up helping spread it to other people because you're contributing to the engagement metrics around it. So I think that it is useful that news organizations have invested in fact checks. You know, I do not think that most of the time they are in any way sufficient to correct misimpressions. And I think that, you know, what we have to recognize, a simple fact, is that the institutions that are producing credible fact checks are probably precisely the ones that are not trusted by people who are most likely to be suspicious. So, you know, if the Washington Post tells you that something is true, that is only useful if you already trust in the Washington Post. And frankly, the bigger the conspiracy theory that the Washington Post is trying to correct with its fact check, the more likely, if you're a person who isn't inclined to believe the newspaper, the more likely you are to believe that the newspaper is just part of the conspiracy by trying to correct it. And so, you know, one way that I think some campaigns find fact checks useful is that they can use them to point other media to not repeat a lie by saying, look, the Associated Press said that this isn't true. But I think they're more valuable to kind of engage with other media and elite opinion on this stuff as a validator than it is something you can count on to talk to voters for you.
Do you think that there will ever be any type of regulatory framework on social media to address some of the disinformation that's out there?
I think it's unlikely anytime soon that we will have, you know, an aggressive regime that where the government is making those determinations. I have a chapter in my book that's set in Brazil, and I spent some time reporting there before the 2022 general election. And Brazil has the, you know, most aggressive election regulator in the world, with the possible exception of governments in like Moscow and Pyongyang. But they have a court that basically, and people might have seen this court feuding with Elon Musk over the course of this year, that has a tremendous amount of power and can order posts taken down, can fine tech companies massive amounts of money, has ordered people jailed for spreading what it considers political disinformation. It is in many respects effective. And to an American and one like me who like lives on free expression, pretty scary. Brazil doesn't have an equivalent of the First Amendment in its constitution. Something like that couldn't exist here under our current constitution. So we're not going to get something like that. I think that there is talk about, possible repeal of Section 230 of the of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which gives doesn't hold platforms liable as publishers for what they put online. And if that were repealed, it would open up, you know, a lot of litigation where people could sue tech companies for things they publish, not just, you know, political speech, but, you know, drug sales, child trafficking, like, you know, a whole lot of areas where they would suddenly become vulnerable. And the companies might respond preemptively to being more aggressive about content moderation, you know, revenge porn, stuff like that, content moderation in an effort to insulate themselves from liability, not because there's a direct government mandate about what you can and can't publish.
So with all the stuff that's happening, do you think the traditional campaign model can still work?
Yes. I just think there are all these challenges for consultants who, you know, didn't sort of come up in the social media age to train their minds to the kind of new ways that information moves and to start thinking about, you know, I think for so long, if you go back to the sort of introduction of the internet as a tool for campaign politics and, you know, 96, 2000, people have largely, political professionals have largely thought about what are the things we now do offline that we can move online and do them more efficiently or more cheaply. And so what first you had fundraising and, you know, effectively for many years, online fundraising was like, let's just see how much of what we do with direct mail we can just do with email and then text messages and do it more efficiently. And then you had efforts to kind of take some version of field and GOTV and let people print out walk lists from their home and make phone calls from their you know, dining room table or whatever. There was never a fundamental reconsideration of how do you communicate in an environment where individual voters now have an ability to communicate at some scale on behalf of a campaign or against a campaign. And campaigns are still fundamentally, and this is, you know, largely true at every level, are these kind of command and control enterprises. And the people at the top make a whole bunch of decisions about what they want to talk about and when they want to talk about it and to whom and how, and try to build an apparatus that delivers that message in their preferred way and have the idea that they can sort of see the whole landscape of what voters are being exposed to at a time and can kind of adjust their communication strategies. That just doesn't work anymore. And so, you know, I think the big shift for people who are working on campaigns now, especially those whose sort of brains were trained on a different era of media, is to rethink a lot of the fundamental assumptions. And that includes a lot of humility, that there was a, you know, you can't know everything the voter's exposed to, which means that you need to have less confidence that the decisions you're making are being made from the same level of authority that they might have been a couple of decades ago. But I there's obviously a huge ability to shift opinion. You just have to think differently about, you know, how people get their information, who the sources of influence are, when it makes sense to respond, and how.
So you mentioned text messaging, and I am curious to your thought on this, because, I mean, Saturday Night Live, like the late night comedy shows, were all talking about how they wanted everybody to stop texting them. And this was the first year, I think, that I have gotten a ton of text messages from the Democrats. I've never seen that before. So what happened? I mean, obviously, we know what happened in July, but why the massive influx of text messaging in fundraising on the Democratic side this cycle as opposed to previous? And why were they so new to the game on it?
It's cheaper and easier. I mean, the big answer, I think, is that you used to need a human touch to send a text message, which meant it was either fairly costly. It cost you something. Or you needed to enlist volunteers and have them do it. And I remember writing in the 2016 cycle about how Bernie Sanders' campaign got, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of volunteers to sit at their home computers with these sort of jerry-rigged online systems where literally they had to manually push every send button because the law stopped you from robo dialing text messages. That is no longer enforced. And so now it's a little like robocalls were, you know, they were novel in the late 1990s. They got cheaper and easier, and you didn't require a lot of expertise to make them. And they scale up very quickly. You tell your phone vendor, I got $20,000 more. Give me $20,000 more robocalls, and they can, you know, within an hour, it's cheaper than, you know, hiring new field staff or even like writing or editing, you know, more mail pieces and stuff like that. And so it's cheap and it's easy, and there are a lot more phone numbers. You know, you can get cell phone numbers that in theory match a larger share of the electorate. Now, if you went back 10 years, it was harder to get as many match rates. You put all that together, and it just means that it's low hanging fruit for groups of all sizes, you know, and it's being used you mentioned for fundraising, but also volunteer asks, some attempts at persuasion, you know, IDs for GOTV. So it's sort of the full range of voter contact is being done that way. But I suspect that, you know, when I talk to people about text messages 8 or 10 years ago, people would marvel that it had this unique thing because, like, your pocket buzzes and you would take it out and look at it. You know, people who might not go check their mailbox every day, who stopped answering calls from unfamiliar numbers. We still got excited when we had a text message because it was still novel to get. The default assumption wasn't that this is a political drunk text. It was, it's my friend or family member texting me. And now it's just like our inbox or our regular mailbox, or where we don't assume that it's a place where you're fundamentally getting personal communication, which means, you know, this stuff is probably getting ignored and blocked and reported as junk and losing its sort of ability to get people's attention.
They didn't stop text. No. It's still going. All right. So to wrap this up, are there any insights that you have that you believe that hold a special lesson for consultants today?
Yeah, I think that the impulse has been always respond to an attack. You know, I think there's scenes in like the war room and stuff of, you know, Carville or Bagala like imploring people like don't leave an attack unanswered. It's certainly like Democrats after the Swift boat thing. The lesson in 2004 was, you know, don't leave an attack unanswered. This is sort of like comms 101. Often the right answer online is do not respond to something. 99% of the time seeing something online, the correct answer is ignore it. It is probably not getting in front of persuadable voters in any significant way on an issue that will hurt you. It will hurt your candidate, your issue, your campaign. That is, now 1% of the time it will, and you need to figure out how to respond without making the problem worse. But you need to have the confidence in 99% of the time that you're going to go back to your candidate or you know, the committee or whatever and say, we can't respond to this. And often that's a difficult thing to say because the politician's ego is involved. It seems like you're being reluctant to defend their honor or whatever it would be. But you're more likely to make the problem worse by rashly reacting to the wrong things than you are by ignoring them. And so having a sense, and I think we get this as a simple fact about offline life. If I told you, like, there are two guys at the end of a bar at a VFW hall in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, who are saying some things about your candidate that aren't fair, you'd go like, well, that's not, but you're not going to say like, okay, we're going to go put out a press release saying that, like, you know, Jimmy Bob and Jacqueline and Oshkosh are wrong. Here are all the reasons. Why wouldn't you do that? Because you're only going to elevate them and draw attention to it. Like that's self-evident in the offline world. There are five people in a park who are holding signs saying with some conspiracy theory, you wouldn't think like, okay, we need to do a press conference. That would be like self-evidently crazy. But people do the equivalent of that in digital because they don't have the right sense of proportion or context when an attack comes. So don't feel the need to respond right away.
Sasha, thank you so much.
That was our chat with Tracy Dietz and Sasha Eisenberg. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thanks for listening.